the OTB Podcast Network.
At 7:48 on this Wednesday morning, delighted to welcome Daniel Harris to the show. Good morning, Daniel.
Hiya.
The end of an era. Ed Woodward, fare thee well.
I mean, I guess it is an era of sorts. I mean, his own missive when he quit was, I mean, it really said a lot when he said he praised himself presiding over an era in which United had won the Europa League, the FA Cup and the League Cup. And as though, number one, this was his achievement, and also as though these were achievements of which one should be proud. I mean, it's quite remarkable, really, the lack of self-knowledge. And I think the thing that it really rings so beautifully fittingly was that we saw some of the plans for this Super League, and we know how phenomenally ill-conceived they were. But imagine how ill-conceived they actually were. The stuff we haven't seen. It's just phenomenal that 2 days, 3 days it should take for the whole thing to be totally knocked over. And that really is the defining feature of Woodward's period at United. Just absolute total incompetence. And not just that, but absolutely mind-boggling arrogance. Not only did he decide to steal football, but he thought he could half-ass it. You think you can take the world game, sweep it into your pocket without even trying, and no one will mind. And yeah, that is Ed Woodward.
There's loads to get into on the Super League angle, but just on the Manchester United angle, why is this happening now? Is it simply the Glazers saying, well, we've got to find a scapegoat and we've got to find it immediately?
I don't know if it's exactly a scapegoat. It's just, how could his position be tenable? Mm. He lied to all the authorities above him, all the footballing authorities. He threw Ole Gunnar Solskjaer under the bus, and then he got a public bollocking of Hazard Maguire and Luke Shaw. imagine having to go home to your family after Harry Maguire and Luke Shaw have taken you to the cleaners in front of the squad. Quite hard to come back from that, I dare say. Quite hard to come back from that just as a bloke, never mind as someone in a position of authority in these places where you've been absolutely decimated. So I think that there probably is an element of scapegoating to it, but there's also a very significant element of, why would anyone care what you say or do what you say or want to talk to you ever again? And that is where we are.
Do you have any more detail on the specifics of the conversation that took place between Maguire and Shaw and Ed Woodward?
I don't. And apparently Bruno Fernandes was also involved, but it is just funny if it's the other two. And it isn't, I'm not dissing the other two, but it's like you're reminded of, what Margaret Thatcher said of Geoffrey Howe, that getting a bollocking off him in Parliament was like being savaged by a dead sheep. And I mean, Harry Maguire and Luke Shaw, both of them done absolutely great jobs in standing up for themselves, standing up for the supporters, but they're not Roy Keane, are they? I mean, it's not like taking a going over off Roy Keane or even off Norman Whiteside, off Mark Hughes, like people who are kind of like, you've got the articulacy of Roy Keane, they're physically intimidating. I mean, Harry Maguire is sort of rhetorically famous for turning up and giving these hangdog interviews of how sorry he is now every time United get beaten. So there's something about being taken apart by those people. So no, I mean, I don't know exactly how the conversation went, but there are various tales about, Harry Maguire apparently speaking quite strongly. And I mean, I think that you can't take something forward without having buy-in from anyone. And this plan was basically, it was six people, six groups, families, whatever you want to call them, deciding that, in fact, football belonged to them. And the arrogance that it must take to not consult with anyone, to not think that, well, you should probably have a TV deal in place before you start talking about TV money. If you're going to take football away from everyone, you might want to talk to government and see what they're saying. Literally nothing. Just nothing apart from that little letter at the beginning and Perez going on TV and making an ass of himself. Nothing. And I think that on that first day, I mean, that first day was extremely depressing. I mean, I was on the Guardian blog, like that daily blog, just as the dreadful news was coming in, like one after the other. The only thing I can compare it to is like when the Conservatives win the general election and you just sort of see the seats dropping, and it's just, you're thinking, what on earth is wrong with people? And then I think that the turning point felt like, for me anyway, it felt like Monday Night Football. And it's hard to know if we're investing Neville and Carragher with more power than they have. But the way that they performed just made you think, this is not over. This is not over by a long chalk. And then on the second day, you like the governor, like Boris Johnson, starts talking about legislative bombs. And at that point, you think, actually, this isn't going to happen. And it felt all along like the ways to stop it would be either the government or the players. If all the players say we're not playing in this league, then it's finished. And if the government start legislating, then also it's finished. But and it's kind of like the opposite. Like yesterday just felt like watching the Conservative Party lose the general election felt like 1997, when they're just losing seat after seat after seat after seat, and they're dropping and dropping and dropping, and then at the end of the night, Michael Portillo goes. And it's just this intense celebration of what feels like years and years of oppressive law just absolutely destroyed in one sensational, glorious evening of revenge and schadenfreude and the joy and beauty of existing. And I think the lesson for us is that it doesn't end here. And the funny thing about this all is that it feels now that this overreach is going to cost them more than whatever money they spend and whatever political capital they've expended, because now there's going to be a proper look at football, and that is going to end up with them having more things taken away than they had to begin with. And I think what we learn is, I mean, it feels absurd to say that we've learned something, because it's always been obvious that when we band together, we have a lot of power. And that is a bizarre thing to say when you consider what goes on with our government. But normal people, when they act collectively, have a lot of power. And it's taken 2 days and these people have capitulated. And that is something to bear in mind. I mean, it's something to bear in mind politically, but it's something to bear in mind when it comes specifically to football as well, because what we can now do is we can say, well, actually, that isn't enough. And what we require is start making lists of things that we require. We require a 50+1 ownership model. We require clubs being protected as community assets. We require legislation that stops anyone taking our clubs away from their locale, because that was also on the table. Like, I think the end point for this league wasn't just the league. It was taking the league around the world. It was maybe basing clubs outside of their countries just to, whatever, for tax reasons or to attract money and investment in those countries. And these are the kind of things that we need to think about now, because this isn't just an opportunity to defeat the Super League. This is an opportunity to row back 20, 30 years of the piece-by-piece destruction of what football is. And we're in a position now to do it, and we need to hang on, and we need to keep fighting, like, because they're going to hope that we forget, and we've got to make sure that we don't forget.
Daniel, you mentioned the word arrogance there a minute or two ago, and like it's just so weaselly the way this whole thing came about. And I think back to photographs on a preseason tour a few years ago of Woodward chatting with Florentino Perez, and you wonder, how long have these guys been in cahoots about this whole thing? How long have they been planning this mutiny? But when you mention the word arrogance, we talk about public relations in the last couple of days, and we wonder, do the Glazers care? Does Ed Woodward care about how this looks now that it's reached its head and collapsed? I mean, do you think people as arrogant as that seem to care or will care about the downfall and the fallout from all of this?
I'm absolutely sure Ed Woodward will care about this humiliation, because this is going to stay with him until the day that he dies. He's that guy. The Glazers, I think, less so. I mean, again, like no one likes being humiliated in public, and make no mistake, that is what this is. The Glazers are quite impervious, but it's partly because they just stay away. They don't live in this country like Edward does. They live in Tampa, so they can just go. They can go about their business in America like this has never happened. So I don't think that is quite the same for them. I think what they do is they imperviously wait things out. It's what happened with the takeover. When the day that they took over, they left Old Trafford in a police van that was being attacked by United supporters. Like, they won't have enjoyed that. They didn't enjoy that. And it felt at the time that if that carried on, then that might be enough to stop them doing it. But then once it stopped, they were able to wait it out. And obviously they had the genius of Alex Ferguson allowing them to win trophies, so things kind of quietened down a bit and they were just able to ignore it. I think that, I mean, they will be able to ignore this because they don't live in this country, as I said, but for them, the penalties are going to be financial. And what can the government do, basically? Because there is now going to be a look at a proper football task force. There's going to be some kind of regulator. There's going to be all these kinds of things. And all of that stuff is going to cost the Glazers money. I think one of the things we need to warn about here is that much as I would celebrate the day that the Glazers leave Manchester United, the problem with United in particular, more so than any other clubs, is that the only people that can afford to buy United probably are people that should not own United, because the amount of money that United is worth and the amount of money that the Glazers would demand, if you have that kind of money, then you are almost definitely a bad lot. And I don't know what we do about that, because it always felt with United that you were kind of always hoping that somehow some benevolent, unfeasibly rich, righteous United supporter would buy it from the Glazers. But then the floating on the New York Stock Exchange was the thing that made you think this is now never going to be possible. And I don't know, obviously, how far the government is prepared to go, but I think that there will probably be an understanding that the 50+1 model that they have in Germany is the way of safeguarding all our football clubs. But how you do that with United in particular, when there are shares listed on the New York Stock Exchange, I've no idea. Are the government going to be committed enough to start requisitioning people's shares, to start saying to all the people involved in this, you're not fit guardians for our football clubs, so we're kicking you out? That's obviously a lot of trouble. I mean, they have kicked Roman Abramovich out of this country, but physically not allowing him to live in this country. But are they going to be able to start requisitioning shares or issuing new shares? Are they going to kick out Abu Dhabi that they've sold off half of Manchester to? And these are the kind of questions that we need to be asking now. I mean, on the one hand, it's dreadful that we're in this position where we're actually having to ask these questions. On the other hand, these questions are being asked, and that is a massive improvement and a complete consequence of that arrogance, of that, of the overreach.
Certainly, Ed Woodward's departure will be seen as one of the positives to come out of this for Manchester United fans. Another of the positives that kind of struck me in the last day or two was this tribalism. This, I guess, you know, the rivalry between Liverpool and Manchester United fans is something, you know, as someone who has written extensively about United, I'm sure you faced backlash, criticism and abuse even from Liverpool fans and from rival fans generally on social media over the years. But do you think this has changed those rivalries forever, that these clubs have now come together in a way in which will never be forgotten?
I think maybe. I mean, I don't think it's changed the rivalry. I mean, the rivalry will always be the rivalry, and that's what we love. So I would never say that would. I don't think that's going to happen. But I mean, it was obvious for years. I mean, I think the first time you really realised it was when the Glazers took over. Because you were going around the country supporting United and you were seeing USA flags and people were chatting to the Glazers and, hey, United, love Glazer, all that kind of thing from City, from Liverpool, but not just there, from everywhere, from Arsenal at that cup. Just after the takeover, United played Arsenal at the cup final and there were American flags in the Arsenal end of that cup final. And at the time, I mean, maybe I was quite naive. I thought that was quite surprising because I was at the time thinking, this stuff's not really that funny. I don't think I would celebrate that kind of thing happening to one of those clubs because we want those clubs to continue existing. And when the Glazers took over United's existence was imperiled because the amount of money that they were borrowing didn't seem feasible to pay back. Like the world, it worked out for them in the end because Fergie was so good. But had the financial crash come a little bit earlier, then who knows how that would have gone. And so it was quite surprising to see that whole USA thing because, yeah, it could have happened to anyone. And indeed, it did. It happened to Liverpool with Hicks and Gillette. It's happened to Arsenal with Stan Kroenke. And that was always the fear that it would not happening to any of these clubs because ultimately there are things that are more significant than your footballing antipathies with regard to football and just with regard to existing. I mean, when I'm sure that the majority of the United support and the majority of the Liverpool support vote for the same political party because their interests are aligned. Like their interests in the wider world are aligned in wanting fairer redistribution of wealth, wanting social justice, and wanting the world to be a better, fairer place, wanting to get rid of structural inequality, wanting to get rid of structural racism. All these things are more important than football. And even in a very purely footballing aspect, it's always been the case. And I remember writing about it when the Glazers were taking over United and subsequently that the way to defeat the TV companies was to put aside the hatred just in this aspect, and not to forget about it, not to pretend it doesn't exist, not when you go to Anfield to feel any differently about it, but you could, because you can see it happening in Germany. In Germany, they started switching kickoff times. The fans got together. They all said, no, that isn't going to happen. And it got stopped. And that is the only way that it works. The same way a union works, basically. As a worker on your own, you have no power. As a group of workers, you have a lot of power, and you need to tap into that power. And the very one of the very things that so attracts TV companies, disaster capitalists, venture capitalists to English football is the fact, is that rivalry and that hatred. And that rivalry and that hatred is the thing that sustains their flow of money, because it convinces TV audiences that around the world that there's something going on here. There's real, like, they love when I was doing the Guardian blog, I was getting emails from people all around the world, from China, from Eritrea, from South Africa, from America, of people saying, this product seems to have been created for me. And I don't want this product. What I like about English football is the localism, the local history, the working people, the rivalry, all those things. And these are the things that make English football special, unique, incredible. And what needs to happen is we need to maintain all those things, but just on these issues that affect us all, we need to stop laughing at each other's misfortune. Not laughing at each other's misfortune with the failure that comes as a consequence of it. Like, I don't expect Liverpool Man City fans to not be laughing at what's happened to United post-Fergie as a consequence of the Glazers. But when it comes to the things that affect us all, we need to all get together, because that's what that works. And I don't think anyone's going to forget that, as I said. And I feel like this overreach would have changed the entire footballing environment and atmosphere in our country. And in future, this is going to happen more. And these people need to look out.
Yeah, absolutely. On the point of Liverpool, we have a bit of footage this morning. It's coming from BBC Sport. They've doorstepped Liverpool owner John Henry entering Fenway Stadium in Boston in the past few hours. We can have a look at this now. So we've got footage of him entering a building. He's not going to really say anything here as he gets doorstepped by the reporter.
Good evening, Mr. Henry. We're from the BBC. Any word for the fans? Any word for the fans, please? Is this the end of your plans for the ESL? Do you still intend to keep hold of your ownership in Liverpool? Mr. Henry, we couldn't hear you earlier. Is there anything you would like to say to the fans of Liverpool?
Yes, I did. Yep.
Is there anything you would like to say? We can't hear you.
You could see there, for people listening on the radio, he said nothing, as you could probably make out there. He has just released a statement that we'll bring you in the next little while, John Henry. But this is going to be really interesting. It's decision-making time for a lot of these owners. If we go back to a situation, Daniel, where football really isn't making any money for them, there may be a realistic situation where the Americanization, when it comes to ownership of English clubs, is just going to diminish over the next little while.
I mean, they are still making a lot of money, and that's the thing. Like, they weren't happy making phenomenal amounts of money. It wasn't enough, and they had to have more. And I mean, it's just, I can't get enough of watching these kind of pictures. I think because the thing with the Glazers, for sure, is that what they basically did was they realised that United was undervalued, which it was, and so they bought it with other people's money, not a penny of their own money, and loaded all the debt onto the books of the club, knowing that the thing that they had spotted that was that in American football was the sponsorship, that everything is sponsored. So what Arsenal did that absolutely screwed them for years was when they built the Emirates, they sold all the naming right, all the sponsorship to Emirates. Like, 5 minutes later, United are busy sponsoring, they're getting the manager's seat sponsored, DHL are sponsoring the training kit. They've got deals with Mr. Potato Head and Turkish Airlines and this and that. They just sponsor absolutely everything. And Arsenal couldn't do it because they'd sold everything to Emirates. Whereas United sponsored everything. And that was just the Glazers bringing that American sports model to England. And ultimately, I mean, kind of laugh at it because it is demeaning that United have all these official partners and Mr. Potato Head this, but ultimately it made the club a lot of money. I mean, it wasn't good for United, it was good for the Glazers. And that's one of the things that, as a supporter, you might put up with if that money was invested in the team, even though it's kind of cheap, it's so cheap and nasty. At some level, obviously, you want the players, and there are compromises that you might make in order to get that. You want cheap tickets, you want good players. But I think the other thing the Glazers were certain they were going to be able to do, and probably all of these clubs owners thought they would do at some point, was the collective TV right deal would go. And then at that point, when you're selling your own TV rights yourselves, then that is a phenomenal amount of money. And when that became impossible to do, I guess they moved over to something like the Super League. And I think probably what hastened it also was the desperation of the Spanish clubs, who don't have enough money even to keep the players that they have, never mind to refresh their squads and compete. And I think probably they were the ones pushing, the only ones who were probably pushing as hard as United were, was Real Madrid, because Real Madrid have got massive problems. And the funny thing about it all is that Madrid, like, they're blaming Corona, but the reason why they're in this position is just staggering mismanagement, because they should be making obscene amounts of money. United are making obscene amounts of money, and they're not selling their own TV rights. Madrid are selling their own TV rights, and the reason they're in this position, obviously Corona is a problem for everyone and they've lost a load of money, but you should be saving for a rainy day when you're making that amount of money. They have no need to spend all the money that they have spent, because they should be understanding that bad stuff can happen. So with the John Henry thing, I mean...
Well, Daniel, sorry to cut across you, but speaking of John Henry, he has just released a video statement via Liverpool Football Club. So let's have a listen to that.
I want to apologise to all the fan supporters of Liverpool Football Club for the disruption I caused over the past 48 hours. Goes without saying, but should be said, that the project put forward was never going to stand without the support of the fans. No one ever thought differently in England. Over these 48 hours, you were very clear that it would not stand. We heard you. I heard you. And I want to apologize to Jurgen, to Billy, to the players, and to everyone who works so hard at LFC to make our fans proud. They have absolutely no responsibility for this disruption. They were the most disrupted, and unfairly so. This is what hurts most. They love your club and work to make you proud every single day. I know the entire LFC team has the expertise, leadership, and passion necessary to rebuild trust and help us move forward. More than a decade ago, when we signed up for the challenges associated with football, we dreamed of what you dreamed of, and we've worked hard to improve your club. Our work isn't done, and I hope you'll understand that even when we make mistakes, we're trying to work in your club's best interests. In this endeavor, I've let you down. Again, I'm sorry, and I alone am responsible for the unnecessary negativity brought forward over the past couple of days. It's something I won't forget, and shows the power that fans have today and will rightly continue to have. If there's one thing this horrible pandemic has clearly shown, it's how crucial fans are to our sport and to every sport. It's shown in every empty stadium. It's been an incredibly tough year for all of us, virtually no one unaffected. It's important that the Liverpool football family remain intact, vital, and committed to what we've seen from you globally with local gestures of kindness and support. I can promise you I will do whatever I can to further that. Thanks for listening.
Daniel, the thing with these apologies, and they seem relatively sincere, is that you can't now go to a revised Super League after apologising like that, or am I being totally naive?
I mean, that was delicious. I'll say that again. I enjoyed that. I mean, I think the thing is yeah, like, there did sound like that tasted, you could taste the shame there. And I think that we need to be very clear that there are different kinds of shame. The shame of what you did, and the shame at being made to look a total arse in front of the entire planet. and it's hard to differentiate between the two. So, I mean, I know he's trying to be dead statesman, like using the language that George Bush used when Saddam invaded Kuwait about this will not stand, this aggression will not stand. But I'm sure that he is extremely ashamed of himself. But I think the thing that you take from that is he's not intending to go anywhere. He's intending to stay because he's got his ATM, that is Liverpool, and he intends to keep that. So I think that is the main thing, that he's not going anywhere and he's trying to apologise and build bridges. Whether he actually feels shame at what he did, only he knows. I don't know. I mean, seems fairly unlikely. But no, I agree that I think what will happen, I think that Super League probably is off the agenda forever because, or at least, the government will legislate to stop this from ever happening again. I think that's going to happen. But obviously, Parliament can make law and Parliament can unmake law. So you may, in the future, get someone even less scrupulous than Boris Johnson. I mean, that sounds unlikely, but you never know. You may get someone even less scrupulous than Boris Johnson who will unmake whatever law gets made, and there will indeed be a Super League. But no, I think we're probably safe from that Super League for now. And yeah. I actually think that we're going to be in a better position at the end of all of this than we were when we started.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.